This audio recording is copyrighted by AboutFacts.net and its licensors. All rights are reserved.
Good, because you brought up a couple of other questions in my mind. First of all, there's a theory, getting back to the solar system and the arrangement of atoms and electrons, there's another theory that states that our whole universe is only part of some greater organism. Have you ever heard of that?
I have. In fact, I think the ancients described, I seem to recall a diagram one time many years ago where the Earth was being held aloft by the god Atlas, and Atlas was standing on the back of a turtle that was quite massive, and the turtle was swimming in a great sea of energy. So, I'm sure that I'm not, describing that particular legend accurately, but I remember bits and pieces of what you're talking about, where the universe itself is a kind of intelligence, or that it has a sentient awareness or presence.
I'm actually talking about even more than that. What I'm talking about is some people actually believe that, say for example, it could be a being somewhere, and he is composed of many universes, which he thinks are only atoms.
And?
And they make up this other being.
So, well, if you're thinking the same thing that I'm gathering from what you said, perhaps you're suggesting that that we as individuals think of ourselves as, tiny little entities living in a very, very vast universe, and we have our own worlds, our own areas of importance, and yet if you were able to sort of microscopically go down into, the structure of each of the atoms in our bodies,
we might find their universes too. That's correct.
There might be life running around on the surface of the electrons in our bodies.
That's right.
They may look, outward and see, the glow of all the other atoms in the environment, thinking that those are stars, light years away. And,
exactly.
I've had that thought many times in my life and wondered about that. Of course, you have to realize that because of the scale and because of the speed at which electrons orbit the nucleus of these atoms, that it means that in a mere second, a mere instant, that each electron probably spins around the nucleus of the atom thousands upon thousands of times, which would be like hundreds and hundreds of lifetimes passing in an instant,
right,
for any beings that would be living at that scale. And so their perception of us as living, breathing, moving organisms, albeit on a much larger scale, is probably impossible to fully grasp. Just as, our lives, as long as they, are in terms of perception for us, may be just the blink of an eye to a much larger, much greater intelligence.
Yes, exactly.
Exists,
that's, that's what the theory says.
Yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful idea. I mean, because it certainly would answer the idea of how could you have multiple universes, multiple layers of existence, all within the same environment, all embedded or layered one upon the other, like the layers of an onion. But yeah, it's a fun mind exercise. It certainly is.
And there's another thing I want to mention. You were talking about the sun before, and I don't know if you're aware of this or not, because this is a pretty new theory, but there are some scientists that are now saying that the sun is not powered by nuclear energy, that it's powered by electromagnetic energy, and that the reason there's heat depends on how an atmosphere of a planet interprets the waves from the sun that are hitting it. Have you heard that one?
Well, not in those specific terms. I know that there are a lot of scientists that have spent lifetimes trying to understand the dynamics of what happens in the sun. I mean, and I honestly don't know how they would determine something like this. Maybe with you know, radar bouncing off the solar surface or something, as turbulent as it is. But, you know, the sun is, I don't know, 1,000 times the size of the Earth. And, you know, the theories that I've read about suggest that they have somehow determined that the core of the sun is not as hot as the outside.
That's right.
Now, that the coronosphere is much hotter in temperature. Now, part of that, part of what you're saying, and, you know, this will get a little complicated, so I'm going to try and sort of simplify this so that, you know, the general audience can understand this. But just like in a pressure cooker, if you want to, you know, cook your, you know, chicken filet sandwich down at Wendy's restaurant, and you want to do it in a way that's not harmful to the surrounding environment where you have steam and hazards of this kind, you put the chicken in a pressure cooker that is sealed, and you allow pressure to build up inside of this environment so that it cooks the food very quickly. And it cooks it at a relatively small temperature, because what you're doing is you're using the enclosure of that environment to raise the energy level without raising the heat to the point where you create steam, which is deadly in many environments. I mean, you can sever someone's finger and cauterize the severed blood vessels so that they do not bleed with a fine jet of steam. Most people don't know this, that you know, when these steam fitters and stuff go through a power plant, you know, you don't go sweeping your hand across little jets of what look like steam coming out of a leaky pipe, because you may have all your fingers cut off and cauterized instantly. So they use other wands and things to check. But so looking at the sun as a giant pressure cooker, imagine that you have the tremendous volume of hydrogen that's all being compressed into this ball that's, you know, 1,000 times the size of the Earth. You know, the pressures that are building up deep in the core of the sun are so high that you don't get the formation of, you know, sort of the fourth state of matter, which you have a solid, liquid, gas, and then plasma, which of course is at the highest energy level. It's the highest temperatures that you'll experience. So if you have you know, material that is compressed so hard and so high at such high pressures that you have an instance where it's like a pressure cooker, you can create energetic events inside the core of the sun, which can be powerful and yet not be at the same temperatures it would see out around the outside of the sun. And what I'm getting at here is that, you know, if you were to suddenly release the locks on a pressure cooker, and you took all that material on the inside of the pressure cooker, and you suddenly released it to the temperature, released it to the environment that's in you know, the restaurant, in the cooking area of the restaurant, you would create a big cloud of steam, and you would scald the people that were in the environment, because this energy would suddenly be unleashed into an environment that, you know, would not be able to contain it. And so, because you have this release of pressure, you have the energy undergoing a conversion. It basically is absorbed into the moisture inside the pressure cooker, and it transfers that heat into the environment very rapidly in the form of steam. It's kind of what happens in the coronosphere, the atmosphere around the sun. All that pent-up pressure that's deep inside the sun creates these magnetic fields, because it's under tremendous pressure and it has a tremendous energy density by virtue of the fact that all of the weight of this hydrogen is pushing into the middle of the sun. So as it boils up, as these magnetic fields boils up through the layers of the sun's inner core, you have different gradients, different layers of temperature and pressure, if you will, and you have reactions that occur both energetically and electromagnetically in the different layers of the sun. You know, there are actually convection cells within the Earth and convection cells within the sun that create these magnetic, electromagnetic effects that you're talking about. For example, if you were to look at the Earth itself as being kind of like a very cool version of the Sun, it's a much colder version of the Sun, you have a highly compressed solid core of iron that's under tremendous pressure and heat, but it can't completely be molten because it's under such pressure that you don't get the release and the manifestation of the energy. But as you get further out, you get more of a high-temperature, highly compressed liquid, and this liquid actually flows. And it's actually responsible for creating the magnetic field of the Earth because you have these convection cycles where the heat will move outward towards the equator, and then it'll start moving up underneath the surface of the crust towards the cooler regions in the north. And then it'll drop back down into the core because it's cooler. And then as it moves towards the core of the Earth, it becomes hotter again and then moves back out towards the equator. And so you get these convection cycles both in the northern and southern hemisphere. And this is rock that has a tremendous amount of iron in it. And so you have these particles of molten iron that are circulating in these patterns, these convection patterns, and it's actually responsible for creating the magnetic field of the Earth. It's kind of an electromagnetic effect. Now, one of the other things that we could touch on is polar shift and, you know, movement of the, you know, the loss of the Earth's magnetic
field. Well, I don't think
like
we
that.
Have to go into it that deeply.
Yeah, but it's all sort of the same thing that happens in the Sun, but on a smaller scale and much, much less energetic scale, too.
The Internet is buzzing with talk about three spaceships coming this way that will supposedly reach us in 2012. I have a big problem with this story myself because they're talking about spaceships supposedly that were picked up around the area of Pluto. And they say it would take them from now until December of 2012 to reach us. And the problem I have is that if these are interstellar ships, that seems to be awful slow. What do you think?
Oh, you're right. You're absolutely right, Ken. You know, if you have the technology to go from one star system to another, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands, billions of miles, within the lifespan of any given organism. And, you know, granted, you know, you may have organisms on other stars, in other star systems on other planets that, you know, may have lifespans of several thousand years, so it may not be that big of a deal for them. But for any kind of an organism similar to human beings, you know, you would have to come up with a propulsion system, a means of getting from one point to another that, you know, for all intents and purposes, would seem almost instantaneous to go from one star to, you know, to our system here, and do it within a lifetime. Now, when I was talking to you earlier about the structure of the atom and how, you know, the so-called zero-point energy is being absorbed by the structure of the atom, and that's what keeps all the particles in motion. You may recall that one of the things that Einstein had postulated, one of the things that he'd said, you know, when he was talking about general relativity and special relativity, was that, you know, an object having mass could never accelerate up to and beyond the speed of light because as it accelerates through space-time, it begins to manifest a greater and greater mass. Now, a lot of people never really spent much time trying to analyze the specifics of what he was really saying there, and what he was saying was that there is this energy that's in the environment, and as you accelerate through the environment, the little electrons, protons, and neutrons of every atom in your body and the vehicle that you're in absorbs a higher and higher level of this energy. It's basically like, you know, if you're walking through a rainstorm and it's sprinkling, you only get moderately wet. But if you're driving 60 miles an hour through that same dispersion of raindrops, you get soaking wet. It's the same thing with accelerating through space-time. If you have an even distribution of this energy in the environment, the faster you accelerate through the environment, the greater the level, the higher the interaction rate will be with that energy. And so you begin to see the electrons and neutrons, protons in the atomic structure spinning at faster and faster rates, and it manifests as a higher level of mass. And of course, when you slow down, when you decelerate, it all goes back to the normal so-called steady state. So if you have a way, like a solar cell, like a photovoltaic cell, of absorbing a certain kind of energy out of the environment, you know, like using sunlight to create electricity. Well, let's say you had a device that would allow you to absorb this energy out of the environment and use it as an energy source to power your propulsion system. And your propulsion system had a way of channeling all that energy into the drive mechanism that accelerates you forward. What happens as a result of that is that there is a diminished amount of that energy that can then interact with the structure of your spacecraft and you as the pilot. And so as you begin to move faster and faster through the environment, your energy that would normally create the effect of greater mass is going into the production of the propulsive force. So energy is conserved. You're not losing anything here, except you're losing the effect of mass. As you go faster and faster, you actually become lighter and lighter. And so the idea that you could never exceed the speed of light because your mass increases to infinity, all of that goes out the window, and you suddenly have an energy source that you can draw upon that would, in any other circumstance, would increase the mass of your vehicle and prevent you from continuing to go faster. And instead, you're converting it to propulsive force. You're using it as a means of driving you faster forward. And in the process of doing that, you're creating, or you have available to you, more and more energy that you can use as a means of continuing this acceleration. So in my view, not only is it possible to accelerate beyond the speed of light, it's probably, and I think is being done by one or more governments on the face of this planet right now, and it's certainly probably been achieved by sentient beings in other star systems that may be, you know, several thousand years ahead of us in terms of their technological advancement.
There is talk of a WikiLeaks document that states that the U.S. has been at war with UFOs near the Atlantic Ocean, and we've even gone to top military alert a couple of times. Have you heard about that?
Yes, I have. In fact, I'm aware of some of the statements and some of the videos you can find on the internet that were put up there by a gentleman. His name's Ed Grimsley. He lives here in California, about halfway down the length of the state from where I am. I'm in Northern California near Redding. And in fact, I have a friend who's a member of a local Indian tribe who went out and bought himself a third generation night vision scope that allows you to see in extremely low light conditions. And he said that everything that Ed Grimsley's talked about, these what appear to be skirmishes or war games or pitched battles occurring out beyond the edge of the atmosphere in space, he said that everything that this gentleman is saying appears to be true. And in fact, within the next week or two, I'm actually going to be meeting with this individual. We're going to do a little stargazing and see what we can see. And I'm actually in the process of putting together kind of a film expedition, if you will, with a filmmaker from the East Coast, James Allen, who is going to obtain some high-end night vision equipment and some high-definition camera systems. And we're going to try and record some of this stuff on film to see if we can't, in fact, give a little more substance to this story than what exists at the moment.
Mm, interesting. What do you think?
Well, I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, I can see why. What do you think of the deathbed statement of Stanley Fulman from NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, that states that waves of UFOs are going to appear over Russia this month?
Well, I think that based on the fact that he's made previous predictions, which seem to have come true, about UFOs appearing over major U.S. metropolitan areas, New York and a few other places, Los Angeles, Seattle. Those predictions, in fact, did come true from what I've seen. I wasn't there myself to validate those statements, but you know, I know people living in those locations that have said that they did see things. You know, it's a lot easier when you're on the inside of an organization like NORAD, and you've probably seen a lot of highly classified documents that that talk about technologies of this kind. It's probably a lot easier to predict when something like that's going to happen if, in fact, your government's in possession of some really advanced technology like the things that people think of as UFOs. And it may be a way of, well, as I was suggesting before, a way of intimidating the governments of other nations that are in the process of doing a little saber-rattling, or maybe aiding and abetting organizations in Iran and other places to try and fulfill their nuclear desires. It may be a way of letting these other governments know that you have a technological edge over them, and you can you know, sort of cloak your statement, you know, in the guise of a kind of fringe event where UFOs appear en masse over a city, and you know, people can say, "Oh no, it was just special effects. It was just somebody, you know, doing a Photoshop number on a cell phone video." One of the things that you may recall not too long ago was this. What appeared to be a large inverted pyramid floating over the Kremlin at night, that there was this video showing this sort of an inverted tetrahedron, rotating.
Yeah, that's on YouTube, yeah.
Yeah, and there's also a number of similar shaped objects, smaller, that seem to be orbiting that object as it's rotating. Well, you know, very often you see examples of what appears to be life imitating art, and this is a perfect example because there was a low-budget science fiction film that was produced a number of years ago called The Objective. And in the story of this movie, you have a CIA operative who's brought into a sort of a military rescue mission that's, I don't know, in Afghanistan or Pakistan, Iraq, somewhere in the Middle East. And they're sent out to try and rescue a special ops group that disappeared in the wilderness.
I've seen that.
But it turns out that they wind up having an encounter with this sort of off-world civilization that's sort of multidimensional. And in fact, the very vehicles that they seem to use to manifest not only their presence, but their weapon systems, defensive mechanisms, all appear to be these same inverted tetrahedrons that sort of flash in and out of reality. But the general proportions of these tetrahedrons, or inverted pyramids, if you will, is almost identical to the proportions of the ones that were seen on that video of this thing floating over the Kremlin. So, you know, my first impression was one of skepticism, because you know, you have to know that Moscow is a bustling city, just like Washington D.C. is, and you have to imagine there had to be more than one individual in the community that had cell phones with a video capability that could have filmed this, and yet there's just this one film. So I really kind of wonder as to whether or not it's, a legitimate event.
Right.
Occurred.
The Nostradamus crowd are now saying that there are quatrains that state that we are in danger from UFOs and it could be a sky war. Do you believe any of that?
Well, you know, I think that Nostradamus may have been a visionary in some respects. I mean, I've heard that he predicted that man would eventually travel through the air like birds. I've heard that he's predicted a number of wars, even the existence or the eventual existence of a personality like Adolf Hitler. Whether or not we will have an unfriendly encounter with a civilization from another star system is anybody's guess. you know, there've been a number of people, Carol Rosen and a number of the individuals that I met through the Disclosure Project, that suggested that people in the know, like Wernher von Braun, said that there was a series of agendas that were being activated over the course of several decades, one of which would be, you know, an environmental crisis or a terrorism crisis or, you know, a UFO crisis, things that would be used as a means of bringing people together, sort of unifying them under a particular type of government, a one-world government, some people say. You can certainly see how if someone was trying to structure and manipulate the way that the world runs, that if you had some really advanced technology that, for all intents and purposes, would look as though it was magic, you know, teleportation, for example, or warp drive that would allow you to move from one location in space and time to another almost instantaneously. These are things that Ben Rich and other people have hinted that some of the major corporations that work and build things for the government are alleged to have developed over the years. And I've seen some of this, some of the activity. I mean, I've seen things basically go into and out of hyperspace, and it looks remarkably similar to the things that you see on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, a brilliant flash of light and an object emerges from the flash that wasn't there a moment before. In fact, I had a I was in the company of three other individuals on State Route 91 just outside of Los Angeles on the way back from an Angels baseball game in June or July of 1993, and saw exactly that kind of an event manifest over the Chino Hills. And, I mean, it was just that kind of a thing. There was a brilliant flash of light, and then this glowing sphere began to descend from this point in the sky. Honestly, I thought that it had been an air-to-air collision between a couple of airliners circulating around the Ontario airport. But as this object descended, it grew in size, was a large glowing ball of light that had kind of diffuse edges. But the thing that I saw behind it, emerging from the same point in the sky, were a series of yellow-orange parallel lines, and these lines all had sort of a different thickness or a different line weight, if you will. And they were all moving in unison with this object as it descended beyond the distant hills. And I thought, you know, that these orange lines were fragments of burning material from the collision. But when I really began to think about what I had seen and sort of, you know, visualize it in my mind, you know, sort of running it back over and over again, I realized that just like in the first Star Wars film, you remember where they make that jump to hyperspace, when they make the jump to light speed, and all the stars in the distance become lines that sort of go to a vanishing point in the distance. Well, imagine that you were on the other end of that transition, and you were looking at the point in space and time where they come out of this hyperspace transition. And what you would be seeing would be the stars that existed in the environment that this vehicle came from. And they would all have that same sort of streaming, slit, sort of, you know, smeared effect. But because you're looking back in the direction from which this object has traveled, all of the light from those stars would be redshifted, which would make them orange or a golden color. And so that would explain not only the line weight being different sizes because of different sized stars that are sort of smeared and moving in unison with this object, but it would also explain the golden color. So I think that's what I saw. But, you know, if that was the only occasion when I'd seen something like that, I might question the validity of the observations, except that I've seen it on multiple occasions, and it's always been in conjunction with a UFO sighting. So I've talked to scientists, some of whom worked at JPL in California, who on occasion were working or involved in a weapons test or a flight test of a weapon system at White Sands, and on more than one occasion these scientists reported seeing what appeared to be a visual distortion of the sky above a given area of the test range, and it would appear as though the clouds and the sky was sort of smeared and sucked up into a funnel shape in the sky, and there'd be this black disc that would appear in the sky, and it looked like a little tiny window with stars and, you know, black space, and out of that manifestation a flying saucer would then come down through this funnel shaped distortion in the sky, would momentarily stop above the ground, this distortion in the sky would then disappear, would all sort of smear back into its normal position, and then this silver mirrored finished disc sort of shaped like a big lens would just take off and would instantly accelerate away at, you know, at an incredible rate of speed, and later would come back to the same spot in the sky. You see this sort of distortion, sort of stretching space and the visual, reflections of you know, the clouds and the sky and everything would sort of stretch up into this funnel shape, distortion in the sky, and the thing would go up into the funnel and disappear in this little black dot with the stars, and then it would all dissipate again.
That's something.
It is. I mean, and to hear this from scientists, from people who, you could hear the tremulations in their voice, the stress when they, it's obvious that here are people who, probably can do mathematical equations that you and I could never dream of, with all the little Greek symbols and stuff, and yet they're seeing something that's the realization of everything they ever imagined in their wildest dreams, and they can't explain it except to say, yeah, I saw it, and it was unbelievable.
Well, you were talking about advanced technology. I think you mentioned transporters. And
yes.
I don't think that transporters would ever work the way that they say they will. And the reason for this is because as a human would go through it, he would be basically torn apart, and he would die. And then something would be resurrected on the other end that looked exactly like him. Mm-hmm. And would be more like a clone than anything else, and that person would never even know that they weren't the first person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you make a valid point there. In fact, there were a number of science fiction programs I've seen on television where that was part of the speculation that was being made about teleportation and whether or not moving a physical object from one point in space and time to another, if it involved this sort of dismantling of the organism at the atomic level and reassembling it at another site, that you would have a complete loss of the personality and the sentience of that individual.
Yeah, it seems to me that a transporter is nothing more than a high-tech copy machine.
Well, and in fact, that was the very premise of some of the stories that I saw, and I thought that, was a very valid argument. I think that Gene Roddenberry, when he put together these, beam me up Scotty devices that they would talk about, the teleportation device, that was the kind of that was the kind of flavor that it had, at least in its visual portrayal, that there would be this beam of light that would come down when you stood at a particular spot, and everything about the human being would sort of be frozen in space and time, dismantled at a molecular level, and then transmitted as a beam of energy to another spot where the structure would be reassembled from a kind of mathematical blueprint that was made at the time of the dismantling. So, yeah, I agree with you. I don't think that it would work in that particular sense, but I also believe that You know, that there's been a lot written about so-called quantum entanglement, that two atoms that have at one point in time had some kind of interaction with one another, or when those particular objects are separated by sometimes great distances, that when you impart some kind of influence, you do something to one of these atoms, that the other one would instantaneously manifest the same kind of reaction. And so, you know, some people have kind of extended or extrapolated that idea out to the notion that if you can create this entanglement between two atoms, that you can actually create an action at a distance by sort of replicating this on a much larger scale, instead of just the one atom of the of any given object, say all the atoms of a human being, and
the problem is that they, in quantum entanglement, the atom doesn't move; it's copied.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't actually move.
You're exactly right, and so I don't know enough about the physics of it to really provide your audience an understandable explanation for how it might be possible, but I will tell you that there was a young man from Alaska, who's a Native American that I had corresponded with for a while, who described an encounter in the 1960s when he was a young man. He was probably 7 or 8 years old. Liked to go hiking in the wilderness around his village, and on one occasion, in the distance, in a clearing, saw what appeared to be a spacecraft from some other civilization that had come down, and he began to sort of sneak up on it, hiding behind bushes and so forth. And he got to a certain point where he couldn't get any closer to it because he encountered some kind of a force field. And the entities that had come out of this vehicle and seemed to be doing some kind of biological survey noticed his presence and apparently realized that he was a youngster and not a threat, and so they basically went about their business and ignored him and then left. And so each day this kid would go back to the same spot, and with each passing day he seemed to be allowed to come closer and closer to this vehicle, up to the point where he was literally close enough to touch the vehicle and close enough to essentially be face to face with these entities. And he said that at one point he was invited up into the spacecraft, and he said the craft appeared to be no more than about 35 feet in diameter, except that when he stepped into the interior of the vehicle, he said it looked like it was as large as a gymnasium on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he did not see anything on the interior of this vehicle that appeared to be even remotely similar to a propulsion system. I mean, he said that the only thing that he saw on the inside of the vehicle was a large circular glass ring, sort of a tube, if you will, about 4 inches in diameter, made of, clear, what appeared to be clear glass. And he said on the inside of this tube was a liquid metal, like mercury. And he said that on one point around the circumference of this ring that was held out from the inside surface of the walls by these brackets that sort of wrapped around the this glass tube, he said that there were a pair of looked like coils of copper wire immediately next to one another, and he said that he could tell by looking at them that the wires on one coil were wrapped in one direction, and that the coil immediately next to that was sort of a mirror image of it. It was wrapped in the opposite direction. And so he looked at these entities, and he said, well, how on earth can you get from one point to another? He said, how can you move through the air with something this simple? And they said that, well, we really don't move from one place to another in a physical sense the way you would, say, walk from here to there, or the way you would ride, a horse from point A to point B. They told him that when this system is energized, it literally moves instantaneously from one spot in space and time to another with no physical presence in between the two spots. And so when I heard this, it occurred to me that, of course, this must be, you know, granted, you know, if the story is true, of course, but if in fact this particular mechanism that he described had any basis in reality, then it gave an example of how it might be possible to do teleportation, you know, probably with some specialized piece of equipment, you know, but it certainly seemed as though what they were telling him was that yes, you can move from one place in time and space to another instantaneously, and it may just be that it's just a more advanced form of, you know, a wormhole, you know, taking you from, you know, connecting two places in space and time, as though you were folding a piece of paper and you were, you know, basically touching one corner to the opposite corner and then sort of laying it back on the table again so that the distance in between, returned to its normal state. So that's the best I can do with that one, Ken.
Now, do you think that we might have bases on some other planets and moons in our solar system and maybe even in other star systems?
Well, I, having to do with other star systems, I don't know. Given what I've seen flying around in and around and near military installations, things that traveled at extraordinary speeds, making, right angle turns at speeds that, you know, at least from the observer's point of view, appeared to be about 9,000 miles per hour or faster, and without producing a sonic boom, by the way, I don't have any doubts that someone, probably, some organization within the United States government, someone clearly has the capability of getting from here to there in a very short amount of time. Probably, at the speeds I was seeing, probably in something, under a day's time from here to the moon. And with the level of telescopes that we have now on Earth and with Hubble and everything else, it may be possible to have installations on the moon, or at least on the far side of the moon, that could not be readily observed using powerful telescopes and things. I've had occasion to correspond with Jose Escamilla, who has used a unique colorization process for some of the film of the moon that was shot by the Apollo astronauts in that program. And he said that when you begin to colorize certain of these gray areas in these photographs, you begin to see areas where it appears that massive objects and structures have been sort of airbrushed out or screened, as it were, from some of the photography, that there appear to be structures that look like buildings and water towers and all kinds of unusual things right there in plain sight that, save for the colorization of the environment, you're not able to otherwise see. And, some really striking revelations in this film that he produced recently, and I don't know if you've seen that, but...
No, that I haven't seen, but I have heard of similar things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I met one of the young men that appeared in the Disclosure Project. I don't recall his name, but he was doing some work, I believe it was in the Army or the Air Force, and he was... called in to do some repair work on a device that would take the electronic signal from satellites and take that telemetry and convert it into a photographic image, line by line. Uh-huh. By line, kind of like the way the picture on your television screen is assembled, many times per second. And he was called over to, I believe it was CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, and asked to do a repair on one of these machines, and he noticed a number of dignitaries from a variety of countries that were all gathered around a large table at the opposite end of the room, and they were looking at what appeared to be a number of photographs and manifesting a certain degree of concern about what they were looking at. And he went on about his business, and these people broke for lunch and left the room, and And there was a young man, a guard, probably like a sergeant or something, who was there in the room as he continued to do his repairs on this machine. And the fellow came over and says, "Hey, Mac, come on over here. You got to see this." And so he walks over and looks at these photographs. And apparently these are pictures that were taken of some kind of an installation that was photographed on the far side of the moon. And he said there were buildings and antenna. And he said, I instantly became very, very, very concerned for my welfare because he realized I was seeing something that was well beyond my the level of my security clearance. But, you know, as he was telling me this story, along with several other people who were sitting there in his presence, you could see a real obvious signs that he was very nervous, even 25, 30 years later, regarding what it was that he had seen. And that, you know, there were obviously buildings of some kind on the far side of the moon that we can't see from here.
Well, there's several different ideas on that that I've come across. One is that we have bases on the far side of the moon. The second one is that aliens have bases on the far side of the moon. And the third idea is that there are ruins on the moon.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard all those stories, and I think they all have a certain level of validity to them. I mean, number one, if anything that Ben Rich said about the advanced level of our technology is true, then sure, the moon would make an obvious outpost for anyone who wanted to, sort of keep an eye on our solar system and maybe protect it from, intrusion by civilizations from other star systems. But it also gives you an opportunity to do a lot of work in a low gravity environment. I mean, we know that there are a number of advanced turbine engine developments that were spurred on by the space program, being able to grow metal crystals for turbine blades in a low gravity environment gives those metal crystals a much higher structural integrity, allows you to run engines at much higher RPM without disintegrating. So having some kind of an installation in a low gravity environment like the moon would be ideal for manufacturing of one kind or another. I can only imagine the kinds of material science that have sprung up around these sorts of things. But
well, funny you should mention that, because I read a story about 2 weeks ago that where a man claimed that he had to do some repairs somewhere, and he came across a machine, a mining machine. It was so huge that it covered, I think, 3 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking to one of the people that worked there, and he said, "Geez, I never saw a machine this big. You know, where is it going to be used?" And the guy said, "The moon." He says, what do you mean the moon? You know, how could you ever even move this?" He says, "I can't talk about it. I'm just telling you," he said, "that this is going to be used on the moon."
Yeah. Well, you know, I've talked to a number of people who've seen vehicles using some kind of field propulsion technology that were of incredibly large size. The individual that I spoke with had the kinds of credentials and backgrounds that gave a tremendous amount of credence to their stories, one of whom was a navigator on a B-52 Stratofortress in the closing years of the Vietnam War. And the aircraft was flying from Guam to South Vietnam, I believe it was, or Cambodia. 1 o'clock in the morning over the Pacific Ocean, had an encounter with a spacecraft that they said conservatively was a quarter of a mile to a half a mile in diameter. And the way that they were able to make this determination, scale-wise, was the fact that this vehicle had a large translucent dome or cupola on top, and he said that they were able to count 27 stories. You could see the individual floors, and they could see the silhouettes of individuals, you know, humanoid-type beings, walking around, working at workstations. They were silhouetted on the inside of this glowing dome. and that they flew over and under and all around this thing, and they believed that the only reason they were able to accomplish this was because this the aircraft, because of its nuclear mission, at least in its original design, the B-52 was completely shielded against electromagnetic pulse or any kind of powerful electromagnetic field that might originate with the detonation of a nuclear weapon. And so they felt that this was probably the reason why their electronics in the airplane were not affected by the field propulsion system of this vehicle. But it was absolutely immense. And, I've talked to other individuals who've also seen craft on a similar scale, at various times and places around the United States, some of which were near military installations. And, if those stories can be believed, or if these stories are true, then it suggests that not only do we have a tremendous lift capability, but we probably have an interplanetary capability as well. And so, if you can imagine dismantling a tunneling machine that's, several acres in size and putting it piece by piece in the cargo hold of a craft that's a quarter of a mile or a half a mile in diameter, the scale of it is what's so incredible, but, the idea that it might be possible given all these other areas of technological advancement, I would say it's not only possible, it's probably happening.
Well, there are several photos of vehicles that were near the moon, and when people use different methods to measure their size, they came up with some incredible figures, like 5 miles and 10 miles in diameter. And what caught me by surprise was the fact that when you make the silhouette of these vehicles, they look like something we would have built. You know what I mean? They sure. have they had a double tail on the back.
Mm-hmm.
And it had wings on the back. I mean, it looked like something made from on this planet. It didn't look alien at all.
Well, I can tell you that the scientist whose name I was trying to remember earlier was Paul LaViolette. And I've talked to him personally, and he's written extensively about the B-2 bomber, for example, as being the example of an aircraft that appears, at least externally, to make use of aerodynamic principles to provide lift and, flies using jet engines. But he has also stated, based on some of the testimony that he's received and some of the papers that he found, that there's a specially designed what was called a flame jet generator that was using the shearing forces of the jet exhaust at the back of the vehicle to create a very powerful electrostatic field, a kind of a static electric charge, if you will, but very, very powerful, that would produce a positive charge ahead of the vehicle and a negative charge in its wake, and that this positive and negative charge could be used to not only accelerate the flow of air across the vehicle, but could actually act as a kind of anti-gravity propulsion that would allow the vehicle to basically loiter in a hover mode over a distant battlefield for days at a time without having to use up any kind of fuel from its reserves at all to stay aloft. And so, I've seen the plans for, I've seen the blueprints and the patents for aircraft that use a variety of exotic propulsion systems. And, I mean, the space shuttle is a perfect example of a vehicle that can use, a relatively archaic rocket propulsion system to get itself into orbit and then, can sit there for long periods of time looking like an airplane with wings and yet, functions as a fully integrated spacecraft. So, I think that, one of the ways that you hide advanced technology, especially if you need to use it on a day-to-day basis, is you make it look like, an everyday object. What would be, a better way to hide a UFO propulsion system than to put it in a conventional-looking aircraft that you can fly around over a city? Oh, it's just a jet, And yet it might be using something really exotic to go completely out of the atmosphere and, to the moon.
Right. Well, let's see. I'm going to ask you this. This is the last question I have for today. Dr. Greer of the Disclosure Project announced that a very senior scientist at SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, has told him that SETI has been in contact with many aliens over the years, but now those signals are being interfered with by our military.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear that?
Well, he's never told me that. I've had some rather long, very detailed one-on-one conversations with Dr. Greer. We drove up the California coast together a number of years ago, and I had occasion to hear a lot of the stories and things that you know, don't generally make it out into, you know, these more public discussions that he has on occasion, and I haven't heard that particular story, but I've had conversations with some other individuals that had some involvement peripherally with what were called superluminal communication systems. This is communications that uses the same sort of zero-point energy, scalar waves, longitudinal waves described by Tesla as a kind of covert communication system. Now, the thing that makes these communication systems unique is that rather than using what would be called radio frequency communication systems, you know, like a radio signal going through space at the speed of light, scalar or superluminal communication systems literally transmit the signal, the telemetry, through hyperspace so that the signal appears instantaneously at the other end, at the receiving end of the broadcast. And so if you think about it, that is the perfect vehicle for transmitting from one star system to another in real time. In other words, if you have the nearest star 4 light years away and you send an ordinary radio signal, it's going to take 4 years to get there and 4 years for your reply to come back. But if you're using a superluminal or sort of hyperspatial or what was the one they, what do they call it on Star Trek? They had a term for it, but there was
subspace
kind of,
communication.
You know, they would transmit a type of scalar signal through hyperspace, and it would arrive in real time at the other end. And so, you know, if you have this kind of a technology, and one of the stories that I heard, you know, from one of my sources was that, you know, when it was a scientist, I think it was John Bedini, who had a hand in developing a kind of radar and telecommunication system that used this technology. And one of the problems that cropped up immediately when they began to use this technology is they started picking up all these signals from other civilizations that were using it as a sort of a covert means of communication to and from the vicinity of our planet with their own people and their own, you know, scientists or whatever, in a way that we had no perception of. It's kind of like, having a couple of guys on the ground with two cans and a string in between talking to one another, and then you got a guy over here with a walkie-talkie who can communicate over large distances, and you can't see anything happening in between. Scalar communications or superluminal communications would be the ideal methodology for any off-world civilization to communicate in real time with their their scientists and their people who are in our area, even though their home planet might be many light years away. So if you suddenly find a way to develop and create a system like that as a means of covert and strategic communication here on the planet with your own military personnel, and you suddenly find all these other people on the channel, then you're faced with a real tough problem, and that is, how do you find a frequency that's uniquely your own that nobody else is going to listen to using this advanced technology, and at the same time keep this technology away from, say, the Russians or the Chinese, and retain that sort of quiet and secret way of communicating with your troops on the ground in real time. So, I think it was either Frank Drake or Jill Tarter was on Coast to Coast with Art Bell many years ago, and I called in and I said, you know, well, the reason you guys aren't getting any signals is because you're using the wrong you know, method of listening. You should be listening for longitudinal waves, scalar waves. You shouldn't be listening for radio waves, because anybody who uses that stuff is really no more advanced than we are. If you want to, you know, talk to some other civilization, you're going to have to listen on a band that we're not using.
Yeah, I never
maybe
really.
Maybe they took my advice. I don't know.
I never really believed we were listening to radio waves. I mean, that sounded ridiculous from the get-go, you know?
Well, I mean, back in the 1950s when, you know, some of the early radio telescope listening projects like SETI started, there was, I think it was called the WOW signal, you know?
This is
clearly coming from some other civilization. There were rumors that, you know, they sent a reply and they had to wait 4 or 5 years before they got a response, but you know, it may be that you know, that has occurred. Whether or not you can sort out what they've said is another question.
Yeah, I think if we did use radio waves, we stopped doing it pretty soon after that, because it didn't make any sense. We're just too slow.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you. This was a very interesting interview.